So we're back in the synthesis of yoga. We're in chapter, the systems of yoga, chapter 4, first published on the 15th of November, 1914. We had got to the part where Sri Aurobindo had discussed, at least briefly, the system of Hatha Yoga, the forceful yoga. Let's read the last sentence or two. On the other hand, the physical results, increased vitality, prolonged youth, health, longevity, are of small avail if they must be held by us as misers of ourselves, apart from the common life, for their own sake. Not utilized, not thrown into the common sum of the world's activities. Hatha Yoga attains large results, but at an exorbitant price and to very little purpose. The understanding being that we spend all of our time practicing asanas and pranayama, etc., and we're much withdrawn from the world, living in these cloistered alcoves, away from civilization, in the quiet of the countryside, etc. And I think the next sentence in the next paragraph says, Raja Yoga takes a higher flight. So the Hatha Yoga is seen as being something fixed in the body and in its vital energies. Then Raja Yoga aims at something greater. That might also suggest to us that yoga began as a physical process and then evolved to address the mind and the higher ranges of consciousness. But that is not so. It might be well to just review a little bit of Hatha Yoga's history to try to get a context and what its aims really were. And then we're going to talk a little more about Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga next week together. We'll then discuss for a few minutes Hatha Yoga tonight, read a page or two in the synthesis of yoga about Raja Yoga, and then come back and look at both of them summarily next time, just so you know where we're going. So Hatha Yoga is not simply sitting in an asana. Asana is a word that means seat. It has an ancient application. You'll find it in all manner of texts going far back thousands of years. And Hatha Yoga is not only pranayama. Pranayama is a word meaning control of the breath. And the practice of breath control, the harnessing of the life energy, also goes back at least a couple of thousand years in recorded Indian scriptures. Hatha Yoga as a system, where it brings asana together and develops a number of postures, seated and otherwise, conjoined to pranayamic practice, is something that develops fairly late. It's probably 1,000 years old, maybe a little older than that. Really, it goes back to the Kanpata yogins, the Nath lineage, that's N-A, long A-T-H lineage, that probably begins with Matsyendranath and then really gets launched with Goraknath. Goraknath, who lived somewhere himself between the 9th and the 12th century, it's very difficult to assign a date to him. He's a semi-legendary figure. Apparently came from the north of Bengal, where he had been introduced to a number of mystical doctrines. It was a place that was in ferment in terms of philosophy and in terms of spiritual practice and effort. And some of the efforts were at the actual transfiguration of the life synergies and of the body itself. Goraknath, as he came to call himself, traveled west through the Himalayas, or along the line of the Himalayas, until he reached basically Kashmir, and there established a system. He was a Nath. He was a master. He had achieved siddhi, the perfection that yogins seek now is patterned after what he achieved. Goraknath left nothing to us in writing that we know of. A number of works have been attributed to him. Goraksha Padadi, Goraksha Samhita, a number of things like that. But he seems to have been the person who brought this system of asana and pranayama to the attention of practitioners who wanted to achieve spiritual enlightenment. Hatha yoga was not the only element of what took one to siddhi, however. Hatha yoga was already complex enough. He probably did not have all the many, many, many asanas that are practiced today, but he had a few. Beginning with fixity in the seat, and then extending that fixity into standing postures, etc. Offering flexibility and tremendous strength into the body. But all of that, all of the work and the strengthening of these postures was to develop the body to be able to hold within itself powerful streams, lakes, oceans of life energy. So the power that came through that practice came in through pranayama. Pranayama, harnessing the powers of life through the breath and impressing the body with this, could extend the body's life, we can't say immeasurably, but let us say considerably. And not simply extend it, but make the health robust. Make the body less reliant on substances to feed it. Because when you're drinking in the energies of the cosmos, you don't need so much in terms of material food. Because your sustenance is coming from a greater origin. Not only did you practice asana and pranayama in his scheme, but also using the locks, bandha, to grip parts of the inner anatomy and hold them and impress upon them this directed force of the prana would result in the liberation in that field of the being. Energies that had been suppressed or unknown. So these three elements, all of them together, were part of what Goraknath brought. That wasn't it. It was the beginning. Because for Goraknath, the city at which he aimed could not be attained simply through this mode. One also needed to learn how to take the materials of life and draw from them the elixir of immortality. So in other words, Goraknath was also a master of alchemy, rasayana, the rasa siddha, was part of what he aimed at, and he would use particles of gold, particles of mercury, heavy metals, etc., in ingenious fashion to extend the life. You may be curious to know that when Marco Polo passed through India on his way back home to Italy from China, he encountered people who were following the lineage of Goraknath and saw them using these substances and wondered at their capacities, because they could demonstrate that they could take a substance and turn it into something of a precious metal. Later, beyond Marco Polo, 5 centuries later, François Bernier also noticed the same things when he came to India as a Frenchman in the parts of the country which in India were open to the French in those days. So there was the practice of alchemy that was conjoined to the practice of what we call Hatha Yoga as a second element in what took one to Siddhi, which made one a Siddha, one who was fulfilled, one who was perfected in being. That also was not the end, because also there was the initiation into tantric ritual. And this was the tantra of the old days, before it had been purified and made clean of all of its elements, because it began in a way that challenged all the elements of our being, all the life powers and all the physical processes, and said, let us use what seems to be transgressive to bring something to perfection. And so foods that were forbidden, sexual contact that was forbidden by society, etc., these things were deliberately indulged in, not with the eye for, you know, personal gross gratification, but to destroy all the claims of ordinary life upon the being, so that once shed of it all, one could be free. And so with these three things, the practice of the tantra, the practice of Hatha Yoga, the practice of the inner alchemy, one could seize upon all the energy, subtle and otherwise, and drive the total nature to enlightenment. The aim going through the 9 chakras, because Goraknath had a system of 9 chakras in his original scheme, not the 6, with the 7th leading to the enlightenment of the infinite through the Sahasrara. The aim was the perfection of the body. The aim was the installation of the consciousness of the divine, the real being of Shiva, the real being of the Shakti, who is the manifestation of the Shiva, into the body, coincident upon all the chakras. All the chakras would be the stationing of a potential divinity, which becomes, in Siddhi, an actual divinity, present in the being. And then the ideal of the Siddha, the Nath, the Lord, would be to roam upon the earth, equal of Shiva, moving upon the globe, desireless, but doing what he desired. Unmoved, but moved to take up any work that he wished, could freely engage in any action without begetting karma, could freely engage in any relation without begetting karma or attachment. And so Goraknath was considered never to have died. There are many who have heard about Paramahansa Yogananda's great guru whom he met, not Yukteswar, but the immortal, and some have identified that person as the original Goraknath, who has refused death and continues to move upon this earth as he wishes, in the guise that he wishes, because nothing can capture him. He has defeated death. And in fact, the stories about the Nath lineage, the Kanpatas, is that often they are quarreling with death, saying, "You have touched one of my fellows. Now give him back, or it'll be worse for you." So this is a tremendously long lineage. It is still active. The Siddhanaths still are there in the northwest of India, still practicing, difficult to find, still present. Now, after Goraknath establishes this practice of Hatha Yoga, a couple of hundred years go by before it gets systematized. And it doesn't get systematized first in what we call the Hatha Pradipika. We've all said all these years the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, but when you look at the old manuscripts from 1,000 years ago, they don't say that. They just say Hatha Pradipika, light on the forceful, light on the difficult, light on the demanding. The Garanda Samhita, the Shiva Samhita, the Siddha Siddhanta Samhita, or Padati, pardon me, is probably the greatest text in the Nath tradition. But all these begin to come into being. Say the Hatha Pradipika, the one that we all know, that guides all the teachers, comes into being around the 15th century. So it's still 500 or 600 years old, but it's pretty close to us by comparison with the old tantric practice, which even predates Goraknath, or the Upanishads, far older than that, etc., etc., going far, far back. So the spiritual practice of these disciplines that lead to enlightenment are far older than Hatha Yoga, but Hatha Yoga brings a particular focus. Its principal motor is breath. It's the harnessing of the life force. We pay all this attention to the asana, and who can get into the best asana? But who commands the breath? That is the one who succeeds in the practice of Hatha Yoga. But also, as you see in the Kulārṇava Tantra, which is a tantric path, there is this aim amongst all these things at a perfection of the body, because there is a sharira yoga, a yoga of the tantra that aims at the perfection of this physical sheath. So when Sri Aurobindo writes about the limitations of Hatha Yoga, we have to remember that there was a century of scholarship, which is before us now, that was not available to Sri Aurobindo. He was down in Pondicherry, a political exile, with a couple of dozen books. More literature than yogic literature, European literature and the like, was present with him. But nobody thought to bring all the great manuscripts to Sri Aurobindo and let him read. So there are some things that he never heard of. The entire Trika philosophy available in the northwest in Kashmir, of which Goraknath was an example, Abhinavagupta, a great example, with a tremendously beautiful aesthetic philosophy, was never even adumbrated to Sri Aurobindo. Let alone could he become conversant with it. He did have with him some of the principal commentaries that Shankara had made on the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras. And so he could become familiar with their material, the Vedantic philosophers. And his commentary upon that is brilliant. But from time to time, as with his commentary on the Hatha Yoga, there is a larger context, which now we can understand and ought to appreciate. There is some overlap. Sri Aurobindo's integral approach is different in this sense. What the Siddhas meant to impose on the body would be a change, a mastery of consciousness over the body in them. They would become perfect, and it might extend to some extent into the glorification of the community to which they were connected. But for Sri Aurobindo, he intended that the divine principle of the Mahashakti from above be implanted in the earth and become an evolutionary certainty, that it emerge, that matter would change. So in that sense, Sri Aurobindo's yoga is very radical and very progressive and aims at something no one else dared touch before. Now this idea of the perfection of the body has become commonplace, but even as it has become commonplace and has entered our vocabulary, do we mean the same thing? Well, I am perhaps prattling on. As I said, I want to come back to this more next week, so we'll talk a little bit more about Hatha Yoga in conjunction with Raja Yoga, but I wanted to say this much so far. Let's continue with Sri Aurobindo's essay. Raja Yoga takes a higher flight. It aims at the liberation and perfection not of the bodily, but of the mental being, the control of the emotional and sensational life, the mastery of the whole apparatus of thought and consciousness. It fixes its eyes on the citta, that stuff of mental consciousness in which all these activities arise, and it seeks, even as Hatha Yoga with its physical material, first to purify and to tranquilize. The normal state of man is a condition of trouble and disorder, a kingdom either at war with itself or badly governed. For the Lord, the Purusha, is subjected to his ministers, the faculties, subjected even to his subjects, the instruments of sensation, emotion, action, enjoyment. Swarajya, self-rule, must be substituted for this subjection. First, therefore, the powers of order must be helped to overcome the powers of disorder. The preliminary movement of Raja Yoga is a careful self-discipline by which good habits of mind are substituted for the lawless movements that indulge the lower nervous being. By the practice of truth, by renunciation of all forms of egoistic seeking, by abstention from injury to others, by purity, by constant meditation and inclination to the divine Purusha, who is the true Lord of the mental kingdom, a pure, glad, clear state of mind and heart is established. So Raja Yoga. Raja means king. So the Raja Yoga would be the royal. It would be the best yoga. It aims at the liberation of the mind. Because if you're not free in the mind, where are you free really? So first, to control the being, mind, life, all emotions, etc. But where does all of that meet us? In the citta. The citta is the generality of our consciousness. Some of it's feeling, some of it is not. Some of it is clear thought. Some of it is mere sensation. But that is the citta. So first, we try to bring peace and purity into the citta. Why do we do that? Why is it necessary? Because before we do that, the inner being, the conscious witness, which is the Purusha, is subject to nature. We think We are our thoughts. We love our thoughts, our favorite thoughts. We think we have emotions. We like this movie. We like this person. We deplore that. We abhor that other. But all of that stuff that is the stuff of our experience is nature, whether it's internal to us in our own psychology or external to us, it's all part of nature. So nature has both an outside and an inside dimension. But the Purusha, the witness consciousness, what we could call the soul, is distinct from that. And until you know that soul, you're in a sense governed by those whom you should govern. You should be in charge of your mind. You should be in charge of your emotions. But look how much they turn you over. So, to get to this, Swarajya, and he defines it right after, self-rule. Swa means self, Rajya means governorship of it, like you have to be king of your own being. Raja Yoga, Rajya. Swarajya is self-rule. So, we have to overcome them. And so the first thing we do is cultivate good habits. We do it through a couple of different things. He ticks off a few here by the practice of truth. That's satya, renunciation of all forms of egoistic seeking. That's asteya, abstention from injury, ahimsa, purity, shaucha, meditation, inclination to the divine Purusha, that would be swayadhyā, swadhyāya, sorry. the contemplation of one's own nature, and Ishvara pranidhāni, which would be to devote yourself to the true Lord, which is that above. So this is an invocation of the yamas and the niyamas of the Yoga Sutras. Note that Sri Aurobindo has not, at least so far, identified Raja Yoga directly with the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But we can take it as a general background that most people will do that. So we need to say something about the Yoga Sutras, which are a body of aphorisms, about 195, I guess, divided into four chapters, which describe and define what our goal of yoga is, how to quiet the mind and how to lift the consciousness from level to level until one finally is free and identified with that thing which is eternal. So the first thing that it does, the Yoga Sutras, is to describe for us the restraints and the injunctions. The restraints are the yamas, and the injunctions are the niyamas. So the yamas, ahimsa, non-injury, satya, speaking the truth, asteya, non-claiming, brahmacharya, following the path of celibacy, in other words, governing your passions. And the last one, aparigraha, not reaching out to steal anything from anybody, not grasping. Then that's fairly close to asteya. The niyamas, or the injunctions, well, first, before we go to the niyamas, let's look at the yamas. These are the things that are asking you to amend the way that you deal with outside life. Ahimsa means somebody else you might injure. Satya means you're speaking truth to somebody, not falsehood. Asteya, brahmachari, aparigraha. You're not engaging in the world or with another person in a way that's hurtful. Then you come to the niyamas, and this is the inner psychological work. First, shaucha, purity. You purify your being. Sri Aurobindo would define purity as responding only to the divine influence. That goes beyond what the niyamas are talking about, but something of that is there. We remain good and pure. Then santosha, which means contentment. You don't need anything. What can you possess anyway? So be content from within. Tapas, work hard. Apply yourself. Be energetic. Swadhyaya, self-study, self-contemplation. Many people think that this means go read a bunch of books. Study and read. Read about this, read about that. But it's the study of oneself that's really important. If you read a book, how does it apply to you? What's your takeaway, as they say these days? How are you going to use it in your life? And then finally, Ishvara Pranidhana, that is applying yourself to the practice so that you come into communion with that thing which draws you. So Sri Aurobindo says, this is the first step only. Afterwards, the ordinary activities of the mind and sense must be entirely quieted in order that the soul may be free to ascend to higher states of consciousness and acquire the foundation for a perfect freedom and self-mastery. But Raja Yoga does not forget that the disabilities of the ordinary mind proceed largely from its subjection to the reactions of the nervous system and the body. We pay attention, don't we, to what we feel, how we address the universe. Is it cold outside? Am I hungry yet? Why does that fellow have more than I have? All of these things are calling upon us, assaulting our mind. It adopts, therefore, from the Hatha yogic system, its devices of asana and pranayama, but reduces their multiple and elaborate forms in each case to one simplest and most directly effective process sufficient for its own immediate object. Back to asana and pranayama, taking a seat and regulating your breath, regulating the power that's within you. Let's make a little correction here too. Raja Yoga adopts from Hatha Yoga. No, Raja Yoga, even if we're talking about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, is a good 1,000 years older than Hatha Yoga. So they were talking about the usefulness of the seat and the control of the breath long before there was Hatha Yoga. And those two are closely combined, asana and pranayama. You begin by fixing your body in one spot and don't let the body move. It gets calm. At first it may wriggle. It wants to do something because it's used to doing. But if you impose peace upon the body, it stabilizes and then holds its energy, doesn't fritter it away. The breath comes into the body, gives it more power, and then the breath looks up and enters into the mind and connects the mind to the body in a way that harmonizes these three instruments. Mind, breath, and body are in alignment. Let's go on forward with Sri Aurobindo. Thus, he's talking about the Hatha Yoga. He's talking about this practice. Thus, it gets rid of the Hatha Yogic complexity and cumbrousness while it utilizes the swift and powerful efficacy of its methods for the control of the body and the vital functions and for the awakening of that internal dynamism full of a latent supernormal faculty typified in yogic terminology by the Kundalini, the coiled and sleeping serpent of energy within. This done, the system proceeds to the perfect quieting of the restless mind and its elevation to a higher plane through concentration of mental force by the successive stages which lead to the utmost inner concentration or ingathered state of the consciousness, which we call samadhi, a word that means equal in mind, equal intelligence, the same. Not in turmoil, but fixed in the essence of being. So kundalini, again a word that in the cosmology, you might say, of the Tantra, is the reflection from below of what exists above. Because above, that energy is called the Mahakundali. She is conscious, she is awake, she is sovereign above. But she coils herself as the involution of the cosmos proceeds and hides at the base of the being. She is there, coiled up, in other words, not showing what she is, waiting. What is she waiting for? She's waiting for us to vivify her, to bring life to her, through our conscious attention, through an invitation to enter into life. So it's in our life that we invite this sleeping divine energy to emerge. It is through us that she courses upwards and re-enters the origin, which is her own being. And then cosmos and transcendence have become complete because of the action of the individual. The individual is critically important to this process. He continues, by samadhi, in which the mind acquires the capacity of withdrawing from its limited waking activities into freer and higher states of consciousness, Raja Yoga serves a double purpose. It compasses a pure mental action, liberated from the confusions of the outer consciousness, and passes thence to the higher supramental planes on which the individual soul enters into its true spiritual existence. But also it acquires the capacity of that free and concentrated energizing of consciousness on its object, which our philosophy asserts is the primary cosmic energy and the method of divine action upon the world. By this capacity, the yogin, already possessed of the highest supracosmic knowledge and experience in the state of trance, is able, in the waking state, to acquire directly whatever knowledge and exercise, whatever mastery may be useful or necessary to his activities in the objective world. For the ancient system of Raja Yoga aimed not only at Swarajya, self-rule or subjective empire, the entire control by the subjective consciousness of all the states and activities proper to its own domain, but included samrajya as well, outward empire, the control by the subjective consciousness of its outer activities and environment. So we see here the individual fuses with the cosmic, and the conquering of with the consciousness of both the limitations preventing us from knowing the self and the walls that prevent us from becoming one with the cosmos. You can see here that those goals that Goraknath had are similar to the goals of the Raja Yoga as stated here. What is stated here as Raja Yoga is difficult to find in the pages of the Yoga Sutras, but we'll come back to that later. So I think we reached a good point to place our bookmarks this time, and we'll come back and rejoin the synthesis of yoga next week. I have a section from Savitri that you might like to hear. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 13, in the Self of Mind. At last there came a bare, indifferent sky, where silence listened to the cosmic voice, but answered nothing to a million calls. The soul's endless question met with no response. An abrupt conclusion ended eager hopes. A deep cessation in a mighty calm, a finest line on the last page of thought, and a margin and a blank of wordless peace. There paused the climbing hierarchy of worlds. He stood on a wide arc of summit space, alone with an enormous self of mind, which held all life in a corner of its vasts. Omnipotent, immobile, and aloof, in the world which sprang from it, it took no part. It gave no heed to the paeans of victory. It was indifferent to its own defeats. It heard the cry of grief and made no sign. Impartial fell its gaze on evil and good. It saw destruction come and did not move. An equal cause of things, a lonely seer and master of its multitude of forms, it acted not, but bore all thoughts and deeds. The witness lord of nature's myriad acts, consenting to the movements of her force. His mind reflected this vast quietism. This witness hush is the thinker's secret base. Hidden in silent depths, the word is formed. From hidden silences, the act is born into the voiceful mind, the laboring world. In secrecy wraps the seed, the eternal sows. Silence, the mystic birthplace of the soul. In God's supreme, withdrawn and timeless hush, a seeing self and potent energy met. The silence knew itself, and thought took form. Self-made from the dual power, creation rose. In the still self he lived, and it in him. Its mute, immemorable listening depths, its vastness and its stillness were his own. One being with it, he grew wide, powerful, free. Apart, unbound, he looked on all things done. As one who builds his own imagined scenes and loses not himself in what he sees, spectator of a drama self-conceived, he looked on the world and watched its motive thoughts with the burden of luminous prophecy in their eyes, its forces with their feet of wind and fire, arisen from the dumbness in his soul. All now he seemed to understand and know. Desire came not, nor any gust of will. The great perturbed inquirer lost his task. Nothing was asked nor wanted any more. There he could stay, the self, the silence won. His soul had peace. It knew the cosmic whole. That began on page 283, by the way. So. Namaste. Jai Ma.